Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to come, and I hope the level is right and I don't blow anyone away with my. If Henry can hear, then I guess we're okay. Yeah. All right. So again, it's really great to be here. And I warned Tom last night that 21 years ago we were together at a workshop in Dundee, and Tom spoke first there. And he made the remark that he thanked the organizers for maximizing his enjoyment of the workshop because he could get his talk out of the way and then he could have fun. So I'm in the same position here. 21 years ago, yeah. Incredible. Okay, so I'm actually going to give a talk about a whole bunch of areas where optimization touches on biomedical applications and data analysis. And I've got some areas I've got almost nothing about, other areas I've got a little bit more detail about things that I've been involved with. I know I've only got 45 minutes, so the parts that we don't have time for or parts that people are less interested in, I'll just cut. But if you do have a particular interest in me expanding on a topic, then and I look like I'm going to just skip by it, then put your hand up and I'll go into a little bit more detail. But I guess the basic theme that's common to a lot of what I talk about is data analysis and how optimization is an important tool in doing that. And the thing is typically that you've got a big data set and you're trying to learn something from it. You're trying to somehow understand it or extract the essence of it in some way. One way to think about it is you're trying to seek rules for making inferences from data. So you'd like to be able to look at a bunch of data and then see some kind of a pattern or a rule such that when you come along with another data point, you're able to make some kind of prediction about that new point. Now, of course, there are often an infinite variety of rules that kind of explain the data that you're looking at fairly well. And among those, you're often interested in picking out the simple one, okay, the ones that depend on just a few features of the data or are somehow intuitive or somehow easy to understand. So an important tool in doing that is this area called sparse optimization. And this, I think, is an emerging paradigm in optimization that's cropping up in all kinds of areas, particularly data analysis and computational statistics. The basic idea is that in a typical optimization problem, when people like me were trained, you know, we were trained that you had to find a solution. It was all about finding the solution, and you prove global convergence results, you prove local convergence results, but the assumption was always that you were looking for the exact solution. And that turns out not to be true in an awful lot of applications. Instead, what you want is a pretty good solution that's somehow simple or structured in some way. And so that's really the game. And that motivates this area called sparse optimization. There are a number of reasons for that. One is this Occam's razor idea where if you've got a whole bunch of explanations of some phenomenon, the simple explanations are preferable. Often the data is noisy, that the model that you used to set up the problem has got some inexactness or noise in it, so there's really no point in finding the exact solution of a noisy model. Often you have some prior idea of what the solution should look like, and you want to sort of impose that on the one that you eventually find. Things like that. So if you pose the problem correctly, often the structure shows up as some sort of sparsity in X. So if you define X to be the coefficient of a certain set of basis functions, if you set the basis up right, then it'll show up, the solution that you're looking for will be one where just a few of the X components are non-zero and the rest are zero. So that's what sparsity means in this context. I'm not talking about sparse matrices, I'm talking about sparse vectors. Okay, so a couple of the things that I'll talk about sort of draw on that, are problems of that flavor where we're looking for inexact but sparse solutions. And this is particularly true in a lot of biological and biomedical applications. And what sort of algorithmic technology do you need? Well, you need all the standard tools that we've been working on for many years. But to impose the sparsity, that often involves bringing a little bit of non-smoothness into the problem. It's typically some sort of regularizer or regularization function that's often a simple non-smooth function. So your algorithm has to be able to deal with that. And the other thing that we're looking at is extreme scale. Often these data collections are very, very large. We can't do a lot of traditional things that you do in optimization methods of forming gradients and Hessians and so on. You have to fall back on methods like stochastic gradient, and I've got some examples of that later on. that have much lower computational requirements per iteration. And all of these things depend critically on the application class. It's sort of hard to abstract, as we've done traditionally in optimization, to write down a paradigm that applies everywhere, like linear programming or nonlinear programming. Often, what you want to do algorithmically is tied very closely to the properties of the particular problem that you're solving. So you need to know a whole bunch of tools, and you need to be able to assemble them in sort of imaginative ways. So these are the six things that I've got material on. I've only got a couple of slides on some of them, a little bit more detail on others. I'll talk a bit about support vector machines, which has been a happy hunting ground for optimizers for about at least the last 12 years or so, a classic problem in machine learning. Secondly, regularized logistic regression. This is a problem from computational statistics, and there's been an awful lot of work about that recently. It's basically maximizing a log likelihood function, but looking for a simple solution of that, simple approximate solution. I'll say a little bit about a problem I've just recently learned about, which is tensor decompositions. Not sure if there's interest here in that. It certainly seems to have a lot of interest in chemometrics and psychometrics and so on. Cancer treatment planning I'll just mention because I know there are a couple of people here that are interested in that, and there'll be some talks about that later. A little bit of work I did with Grace Wabber 5 years ago on using semi-definite programming in cluster analysis. I'll just mention that. And finally, a topic that sort of fell into my lap about a year ago from a colleague of Panos's at Penn State, where we're using integer programming and semi-definite programming to design captive breeding programs. So this one's kind of a little bit off the wall, but it was a lot of fun to work on. Okay, so classification. What's the basic idea in classification? As I said, classic problem in machine learning. They have huge conferences about this, and big communities of very, very smart young people working on this stuff. But one of their fundamental problems is that you've got a bunch of feature vectors, say M feature vectors, labeled XI, and there are N of them, sorry. And each of them you can think of as being a real vector with M elements. And each of them has a label, plus one, minus one, binary label. And the rule that you're trying to learn here is you're trying to learn a hyperplane defined by W and B, a slope and an intercept. And you want to pick W and B such that when you plug X in and make a linear function out of it, that W transpose B plus X will tend to be negative if the label is plus 1, negative if the label is minus 1, and positive if the label is plus 1. So you're looking for a plane that sort of neatly divides the two cases. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, is it really the case that you want a plane or do you want something that divides it?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'll generalize that in a moment. But the picture is something like this. You might have two classes of dots here, and you're sort of looking for a line like this that does a pretty good job of separating the two. Okay. So if you're really lucky, then it's possible to find a line that really does divide them perfectly. And so you're faced with a situation of which, obviously here there are many lines that would work. There's one that one works perfectly well, that one works fine, that one works fine too. So which of these three do you think is the most suitable of these three possibilities? This one, right? This one's kind of the best because the reason it's the best is that the sample points that you're seeing are sort of drawn from some unknown underlying distribution. You're only seeing some of the data here. And so the question you ask is, okay, if I really knew more of the data, I would want my plane, the one that I've just constructed, to actually do a good job at partitioning the unseen data as well. Now, if you have a plane that's jammed up right up against the edge of the sample space, the chances are that when more of the data is revealed, a lot of these blue points are going to leak, you know, over to this side of the plane. So that's not a very good one. But the one that sort of tries to maximize the margin is probably going to do better when more of the data is revealed. And you see that here. If I reveal more of the data, the first one and the second one have a lot of incorrect points. The third one still does pretty well. Okay. So it turns out that you can, you want to pick the W and B, so you do a pretty good job of fitting the data that you can see, which I'll call the training examples. But you don't want to do too good a job at fitting it, because as I said, when more of the data is revealed, it might, all this extra work you did in sort of overfitting the data that you see might not do a very good job of nailing the rest. Okay. Now, you can write this down as an optimization problem, and it turns out the problem of finding the nice plane, the one that is right in the middle there, can be formulated as a quadratic program, okay, the first one there. And basically, it has those two sets of classification constraints. You sort of say, you have a right-hand side of plus one and minus one to impose a bit of, to determine the scale. Otherwise, there's a scaling parameter floating around. But you get rid of that by putting, by requiring not just W transpose B to be greater than zero, but actually greater than one for the positive example. And you try to minimize the norm of W squared. That turns out to be the right thing to do if you want to maximize the margin, which for reasons I won't explain. Now, this sort of thing still works even if you can't neatly separate the data. If the data doesn't partition, then that first problem is infeasible, but you can still write down a penalty for the violations of those constraints and construct a penalty term here, summing over all the data examples, and leave in the W transpose W and have lambda, which kind of weights off between these two objectives. And you can minimize that. And you can prove that that also does a good job, an optimal job in some sense, at finding the best W. Now, this is you can write this as a quadratic program, too, by introducing some artificial variables to represent these maxes. You can also take the dual. And this is the form that a lot of people attack algorithmically since 1998 or so, because it's a nice convex quadratic program. It's got some bound constraints. These things are basically, the alphas are sort of Lagrange multipliers for these guys. It's got a positive, usually positive definite Hessian. And the constraints are just bounds, but there's this one extra linear constraint, which is a little bit awkward to deal with. So there's been a lot of work that's gone into solving this using different kinds of optimization. But you can't just usually throw it at a QP solver because usually it's really big. Okay. So, and the other problem is that this matrix is usually dense. So it's not like a lot of the problems that we're used to dealing with. This matrix turns out to be inner products of pairs of feature vectors. Okay. Now, to answer Tom's question, usually it's not possible to neatly separate the two sets of data. And what you really need is sort of a surface rather than a plane. So the trick that you do there is that you sort of project all the feature vectors into a higher dimensional space. This is how you can think about it. You think in terms of a mapping phi, which takes the original feature vector and projects it into some Hilbert space, and then you do a classification, a linear classification in the Hilbert space, in this higher dimensional space. When you collapse it back down into the original feature space, it turns into not a plane anymore, but some sort of a surface. Usually not even a connected surface, okay? It's usually got curves and bits and pieces and so on. There's this checkerboard example where you can divide between squares of a checkerboard. So the problem that you have to solve, it looks exactly like the one I had in the previous slide, except instead of the xi's here, I've got phi of xi's, where phi now is lifted into this higher space. Okay. Now, if you write down the optimality conditions for this problem, you'll find that the optimal w has to have this form. It has to be a multiple of all the phi of xi's with some coefficients alpha I and the labels yi. That's the plus one, minus one labels. So if you know that the solution has that form, you can plug it back into that the problem that I had earlier, which is an optimization over Hilbert space. W is an object in Hilbert space. You can now reduce W to a finite set of coefficients alpha I going from 1 up to m, and get yourself a finite dimensional problem. Okay. So this looks, again, like the original linear problem, except now instead of a W transpose W, we've got a general Hessian in that first term, and we've got something slightly different in the second term, but still quite closely related. Okay. So now the question is, how do I choose this phi? How do I choose what space to project up into? And you can, if you want, pick a phi that's explicit. You can, for example, take all of the components of M, and you can take all possible polynomial products of those of X, I mean, and all possible monomial products of components of X, and get yourself a higher dimensional vector, and that's one way to do it. But another thing you can notice is that when you're setting up this problem, you don't actually need to know phi. All you need to know is this this matrix psi, and each element of psi is a product of the two labels, plus one and minus one, times an inner product of two of the phi functions, okay? And so you don't need to know phi itself. All you need to know are these inner products. And this is the observation that people made maybe sometime in the late 90s, mid-90s, something like that, if you only need these inner products, then instead of actually picking phi, you can just pick a kernel function that tells you, if you plug in two arguments, S and T, it tells you what the inner product of phi S and phi T is. And provided you define this function as some measure of dissimilarity between S and T, and provided you can evaluate K for any two arguments, you can set up this problem and solve it. And not only can you solve it, but you can use it to construct a classifier. In other words, you never need to know the phis. Okay? You can always work just in terms of the kernel function K. And it turns out there are a number of kernel functions that are commonly used, but this one is probably the most popular, the so-called Gaussian kernel, where you just take the difference of the two arguments, square it, divide by some scaling factor, and then take the exponential. And there are various reasons why that's not a bad thing to do. So you can set up that problem, you can solve it, you can get a bunch of alphas and a B, and then the whole object is that when I come along with a new data point X, I want to be able to predict whether it's got a plus one or minus one label. Well, you just plug X into this formula, and it turns out that if that's positive, you say, okay, that X probably has a label of plus one. If it's negative, it's probably a minus one. Okay. So what are the problems with this approach? Well, here too, this matrix psi is large and dense. What else do I have here? Okay. And you sort of need special algorithms because it's such a big problem. Okay, here's something that I did recently with my student. The other thing about this matrix size is that it's often very poorly conditioned, and you can often approximate it pretty well with a low rank approximation, VV transpose. And there's recent work more and more lately on finding approximate factorizations of big matrices by doing random sampling. So there's this technique where you just pick a bunch of columns out of psi, do a factorization of that, and end up being able to construct a pretty good rank R approximation. And there is a lot of statistical analysis of how good that approximation is. So what we did was to actually spend some time constructing this V, which gave us a low rank approximation, and then just look at the kernel problem, the kernelized problem, and plug in VV transpose wherever we saw psi. And so we get this. And we do a change of variables. We just replace the alpha, the original variables, by gamma, V transpose alpha, and this is what you get from that. Now, this is a lower dimensional problem. The original problem had alpha was in Rm. Now the gamma is in RR, where R is the size of the rank that you've chosen, which might be much smaller. It might be only 10 or 20 or something. Okay, so this is a much smaller problem. It still has a lot of summation terms here if you've got a lot of data, but the number of variables is pretty small. And it turns out, not only that, but it has exactly the same form as a linear SVM, okay? The one without the kernel. It has exactly that form. So you can apply all those techniques that were just specialized to the case where you're looking for a plane, not a surface. Okay, so it's still a big problem in the sense that there are a lot of sums here. So if you had to actually compute a subgradient of this thing, it would take a long time to evaluate because you'd have to iterate, you'd have to have a loop that went over all these terms, and there might be millions of these. So this area in the last maybe 5 years and probably even more recently, people have been applying stochastic approximation to this method. This is a technique that's been around in the Russian literature for a while. It was developed independently in the machine learning literature by some of these authors. And the connection was really made only last year that people realized they're doing roughly the same thing. But Sakis and his collaborators have been doing similar things also in this incremental subgradient. So how does this work? Basically, how stochastic approximation works is that it says, okay, we're not going to be able to get an exact subgradient. It's too much work. What I'll do is look for an unbiased sample of the subgradient. How do I get an unbiased sample? I pick one of the terms in the summation at random. Just flip a coin, pick one of them, and take the subgradient of that term, okay? And I'll use that as my estimate of the subgradient of the whole summation. And this one, of course, I can get the exact gradient because this is trivial. And then you just take a step in that direction. So you can see this vector here that I'm stepping in is the gradient of the first part plus my estimate of the subgradient of the second part from based on a single term in the sum, namely the ik term. And then I move in that direction by some step length, eta k. Okay? And how do you pick eta k? Well, that's kind of the name of the game. You can't really do a line search because that's expensive too, right? Whenever you want to do a line search, you're going to have to evaluate this function, so you can't do that. You could think of doing some sort of a surrogate line search that's based on some sort of approximation to this term. But what's typically done in stochastic gradient is that you just stick to a step length rule, like you pick eta to be some multiple of 1 over k, where k is the iteration number, or 1 over square root of k, all right? And you can do analysis on this, and the analysis actually in the Nemirovsky paper is very, very simple. Well, I said simple to Nemirovsky, and he got offended. He said it's elementary, okay? So it only takes half a page or something. And basically what it shows is you get convergence and expectation. You can prove results like that the value of the function at the latest iterate minus the optimal value, the expectation of that decreases like 1 over k as k goes to infinity, all right? Now, that's actually really slow, right? It's not even linear convergence. Linear convergence is where this is less than or equal to rho to the k for some rho less than 1. It's even slower than that. But it's, you know, considering that we're doing such a crude thing, we're taking such a crude estimate of the subgradient and just blindly taking a step in that direction, yeah, it's probably about as well as you can do. It turns out there are methods that people can tune these up and make that 1 over k squared rather than 1 over k, but that's still not linear, okay? Yes, it depends on the distribution. You're assuming also always that there's an unbiased estimate of the subgradient, but if your estimate has really big variance, then that makes the convergence slower. So it depends on, this Q depends on the variance of your subgradient estimate. You probably can. This is viewed a little bit as kind of an alternative to sample average approximation. There are things you can do where, for example, you don't pick a single element here. You might pick a subset, like 10 of them, and average those. And that would tend to give you a lower variance estimate, for example. So I think there probably are imaginative ways that you can combine these different approaches. This approach of 1 over k, it turns out that works when you're dealing with a strictly convex function and you know what the lower bound on the curvature is. And it turns out that is the case for this problem. You know that lambda is a lower bound on the curvature. If you've only got a weakly convex function, you have to use a slightly different rule of 1 over square root of k. And not only that, but you have to do you have to keep a running weighted sum of the iterates. And if you do all that, you get a expectation convergence at that rate. Okay. All right, I'm going to have to sort of skip over the rest of that. But basically, we did that on this reduced problem, in this work that I did with my student, Sang Lee. Probably the most interesting aspect of this was that we were able to construct from this a sparse classifier. Now, why is that true? We solve for gamma, and then we recover an alpha by finding, obviously there are infinitely many alphas that satisfy this equation because this V transpose is an R by N matrix. It's a very long, skinny matrix. So we recover an alpha that only has R non-zeros in it, okay? So it's a sparse alpha. And from that, we're able to construct a sparse classifier. Sparse in the sense that normally in a classifier, you have to evaluate m values of the kernel. So if I come along with a new x, and I ask you to tell me whether it's a plus 1 or a minus 1, you have to evaluate this sum, but you have to evaluate k of xi and x for every I. We're saying, no, you don't have to do that anymore because most of these are zero, and you only have to evaluate this for the non-zero ones. So you actually can get a classifier in a lot less work. Okay. All right, second topic, and this one, as I said, there's been a lot of interest in this lately, regularized logistic regression. So the game here is kind of similar. Set up, at least one way to set it up, you've got a bunch of feature vectors, you've got a bunch of binary labels. Okay, but here, instead of just wanting to classify future examples as being plus one or minus one, you want to produce some probabilities, okay? So you want to construct a function so that when I come along with a new vector x, I want you to tell me the probability of it being a plus one label and the probability of it being minus one. And these two things, of course, have to add up to one, okay? So these are two functions between zero and one. Now, how do I construct those functions? I construct them by looking at this training data. So you give me a bunch of examples that are labeled. I want to use those to learn this vector z, okay? I want to learn the z. I want to find a z that does a good job at classifying all that training data. And I'm going to use that z so that when I come along with a new x, I can plug it into this function, combine it with the z, and come out with two odds. All right. So how do we set this up? Well, let me use L plus to define the positive labels, L minus for the negative labels. Basically, what you want to do is choose the z so that for all the positive examples, this should be I in L plus, for all the positive examples, you want z transpose x to be negative. Because when z transpose x is negative, the p plus is close to 1 and the p minus is close to 0. Okay? So then it'll correctly label that case. And the opposite if I is a negative example. So you can set up a log likelihood function. You can write down the negative of the, and scaling for convenience, you write down the negative of the log likelihood function, and it's basically given by that formula. So you plug in all the labels, negatives and positives, you plug in that formula for P plus and P minus, and you try to pick the Z to minimize this. I've made it the negative log likelihood, so you minimize that. Yeah. I'm sorry? Why did not? They do. Right. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I've written them in a slightly unconventional way. Okay. So let's see. So so this is a function we're trying to minimize, this L of Z. But we're actually looking for a sparse solution here. We would like to find a Z that only has a few non-zeros, because we would like to be able to form the classifier just based on a few components of the vector X, right? This feature vector can be incredibly long. We would like to learn from this process that only a few features in the vector are important in making the distinction. That can really give us a lot of insight into the data, okay? So how do we achieve that? We add on this regularization term, the one norm of Z, okay? And so the thing we actually minimize is not just the negative log likelihood, but what we add on some coefficient, some regularization factor, plus the one times the one norm of Z. And we solve that. Okay. All right, so what are the computational issues here? Well, the problem is, again, that this is often a really big problem. The size of the individual X vectors can be incredibly long, and there might be a lot of them, okay? Let's look at the cost of minimizing this from an optimization point of view. First of all, suppose you want a gradient of L. To get a gradient of L, you have to do this evaluation, which takes a certain amount of time, okay? At least you have to do one of these for every data point, so, and then the cost of a Z transpose X. Well, that might not be too big. If only a few of the components of Z are non-zero, that can actually be pretty cheap. But the main thing you have to do is do this matrix vector product, where this matrix is a matrix constructed from all the feature vectors. So it might be, you know, astronomically big. Okay. Now, it turns out that you can actually get some mileage by just working with a piece of the gradient. There's no reason why you should have to step in all the components of Z at once. Why not just pick a subset of the Z components and compute a partial gradient and step in that? That turns out to be reasonable to do, because to do a partial gradient, you're going to need a partial matrix vector multiply, so it's a lot cheaper than the whole gradient. Similar tricks you can play with the Hessian. The Hessian is you can write it down very neatly, okay, but it involves a matrix product with X, which again is prohibitive, all right? But again, you might only need a part of the Hessian, and not only that, you might just want to sample. Instead of doing a full matrix-matrix multiply, you might just want to sample random columns of X and form a approximate Hessian based on that random sample. And actually, my colleague Nosadol has been doing this in some speech recognition applications for Google, and the same idea works well in many other contexts as well. You can get a Newton-like method at a much lower cost. Yeah. The sparsity of Z, yeah, it does, and also on the sparsity of X, the big matrix X. Right.
The smallest number of zeros that comes into conflict?
Yes, it probably does in this case. So this L1 has been recognized by statisticians for a long time as being some sort of a surrogate for L0. You can manipulate that by messing around with the lambda. So I can mess around. Bigger lambda makes this more sparse, right? If lambda is really huge, the solution of this is going to be z equals zero. Well, yeah, I'm not going to talk about compressive sensing, but basically, we can talk about this later, but basically you manipulate the sparsity by changing lambda. And often you don't know what lambda should be a priori, so you actually want to solve for a bunch of lambdas and use a validation set to pick the best one. So that's an important, that's actually an important topic. Okay, so here's the strategy. I'll just run through this quickly. We've implemented this. You basically take a partial gradient projection step. So you evaluate a piece of the gradient, and you take a step here, and you can think of this as being like gradient projection in constrained optimization. This kind of subproblem recurs through many, many different applications, but I'll just gloss over it here. You actually try to soup it up by using some second-order information in the way I've described. Once you've figured out which components of Z you think are going to be non-zero at the solution, you do sort of a reduced step in those components. This is the usual kind of machinery for accepting and rejecting steps. And if the step turns out to be unsatisfactory, you increase the damping here. And increasing alpha makes the whole step shorter. Okay, so I won't get into too much of the strategy here. You can also soup it up. There are a lot of applications where you're not looking for a Z that's sparse element by element, but the elements of Z group naturally into these sort of subvectors. And you want a sort of a group regularization strategy. Instead of the one norm of Z, you want a sum of two norms of subvectors of Z, okay? So, because the elements of Z might be related in some natural way. And this whole approach can be extended to that pretty efficiently. The toy problem that we did in this paper a couple of years ago comes from a longitudinal eye study in a small city in Wisconsin where they managed to talk a huge subset of the population into having a very detailed eye exam, and then they come back every 5 years and see how they're doing. And there's this data set that the statisticians it's just gold for the statisticians. It's the gold mine. So the thing we used it for was to look for the onset of myopia over a 5-year period. And we were trying to identify which risk factors and which combinations of risk factors were most important in predicting whether people would get myopia over this time. Now this was a toy problem because we only had 7 risk factors, but we examined also all the interactions between those 7 risk factors. And if you look at all possible interactions, you actually have a problem with 128 variables, 2^7. Okay. And it turned out, to cut a long story short, yeah, the risk factors were the gender, males are more likely to get myopia, income, lower income people more likely. If you had myopia as a child, it was more likely to keep getting worse as you get older. Cataracts, whether you're a smoker, whether you took aspirin, whether you took vitamins, okay? So it turns out the 4 biggest risk factors were, first of all, if you had cataracts. Secondly, if you're a smoker who didn't take vitamins, that was a bad thing. It turns out that if you're a smoker, if you took vitamins, they really helped if you're a smoker. But if you're not a smoker, it didn't make any difference. Okay? So the moral is if you smoke, take vitamins as well, and everything's going to be okay. And then a couple of others here. We also did a much larger application based on genetic data. And when you're dealing with genetic data, the feature space absolutely explodes, particularly if you start looking for interactions between things along the genome. And we were looking for risk factors on chromosome 6 for predicting rheumatoid arthritis, and that was a much harder problem. There's another problem that my students have been working on lately from a data set from this paper, which I thought I would mention, but it's trying to detect so-called splices in DNA. And of course, I know nothing about this, but basically a splice is the boundary between a coding and a non-coding region, intron and an extron. And you want to look at a sequence of 9 base pairs that kind of surrounds the boundary. The boundary, I think, is like here or here. This is a coding and this is non-coding. And you want to be able to look at this string of 9 base pairs and say whether it's you think it's a splice site or not. Okay? And there's an awful lot of training data in this data set. There are sort of 8,000 positive examples, 200,000 negative examples. So how do you set this up as a problem? Well, you look at a bunch of strings like this, you look at their labels, and you try to learn a rule so that when I come along with a new string of 9 elements, you should be able to tell me the chances of it being a splice or not a splice. There are a lot of details on how you code this up. First of all, they like to code it up by having 4 binary variables for each of the 4 base pairs. Okay? A is 1000, C is 0010, and so on. You're also looking not just for individual patterns, but also interactions between all possible pairs in the string, or all possible triples, as another way that you can, another sort of thing that you can use to predict the signature. You can reduce the size of, I was typing this after I got back from dinner last night, so pardon the typos. But 2 of these you can eliminate, because this G and the T are always here. So you can forget about them and just concentrate on the other 7. Okay. But when you put in all the possible combinations, you end up with 33,000 variables, so it's still a pretty big problem. It's also got group regularization, because you want to not just have a sparse, you're trying to isolate which of the individual things or which of the pairs that predict the answer most readily. And so you end up with a group regularizer rather than an L1. Okay. Yes? It's not. There are other data sets where they go to 21 or something. So this is just the one they used in this data set. Okay. I just want to make one remark about this that I think is very generally applicable to this area. When we solve this for a range of lambdas, I'm not going to have time to explain this, but basically the big values of lambda are down here. So these are the ones that give the sparsest solution. Each of these curves is one of the groups. Could be an individual effect, which I think are these guys. It could be pairs of base pairs or triples. These ones are the sizes of group 4, the groups of size 4, 4 base pairs. And these are the groups of size 5, I think. And you can see as you decrease lambda, more and more of the Z's move away from 0, okay, because it's relaxing the sparsity constraint more and more. But the interesting thing here is that this is what happened when we stopped the algorithm at a pretty loose convergence tolerance. This is what happened when we insisted on it solving more accurately. And there are pretty big differences between these two plots. For example, you can see here that the groups of size 5, which are these dark purple lines, are actually quite significant in the solution, in the approximate solution. But when you tighten the tolerance and solve it again, those have pretty much disappeared, and all the energy from those has gone into these groups of size 4. Now, what's the moral of the story here? It's kind of disturbing from an optimization point of view, because by tightening the tolerance, we've got quite a different solution. But the statisticians don't care about this. They don't really care about the exact solution. They want a solution that does a good job of solving the problem that they really want to solve, which is to do a pretty accurate prediction. So it's quite possible, although we haven't checked it, that both of these solutions do a good job at classifying the data in the unknown test set, the data that you didn't use to construct the model. And if that's the case, then both of the solutions are equally valid. Okay? So the priorities of the statisticians are quite different from the priorities that we were brought up with as optimizers. So I'm getting short on time, so I think does anyone want to hear about tensors? Yeah. Okay, I'll just say a little bit about that. All right. So a tensor is you all know about how you can assemble data in a two-dimensional matrix, n rows, m columns. Often there are data sets where you can naturally arrange them as a higher dimensional object, 3 or 4 or even higher. Okay, and you want to extract from that some fundamental information about what's going on in that data. So you might look for a low-rank decomposition. This concept is very familiar in matrices. If you look at a matrix, you might want to find the rank 2 or rank 3 matrix that best approximates the full matrix. Now, that's a solved problem. You can get that by doing a singular value decomposition and just taking the top 3 singular values. Tensors is much more difficult. All kinds of weird things happen once you go beyond the matrix case. And I've mentioned a few of them here. So it's a happy hunting ground for theoretical people in numerical linear algebra. Okay, but the numerical guys tend to say, okay, whatever, fine, you know, let's just try and solve the problem anyway and see what happens. So in other words, let's pick an F. F is the rank that you're looking for. And let's find a tensor of rank F that best approximates the observed data X. Okay. And they arise in a bunch of different areas that I mentioned earlier. Functional MRI, image compression, and so on and so on. Okay. Here is one example from a paper from Rasmus Bro and his collaborators. He tends to use ones like this a lot. So he's got 27 solutions containing 4 fluorophores. So these are chemicals that where you excite them with radiation of a certain wavelength, it then emits radiation of other wavelengths. Okay. So he's got 27 solutions with 4 fluorophores at different concentrates. He excites them with 24 wavelengths. He measures emissions at another 121 wavelengths. So he ends up with a three-dimensional tensor with those dimensions. Now, he knows from a physical law that this tensor should be pretty much rank 4 because there are only 4 active chemicals, 4 fluorophores in this thing. Now, it might not be exactly this, but because there might be some interactions between them and there's some errors in the measurements and so on, but he'd like to find the best fit of a rank 4 tensor to the observed tensor. Okay, so you can do that in a least square sense or some other way. So the algorithm that's used is the standard algorithm, which is unsatisfactory in some ways, is this alternating least squares. And this is one where you write down a tensor approximation, then you try to identify the 3 components and the sort of coefficient to best fit the data in the least square sense. And the way you do it is to fix the B and C and solve for A, basically. And that's a least squares problem. Normalization for lambda is not a big deal. And then you fix A and B and solve for C, and then you fix A and C and solve for B. So it's a very obvious idea. You just cycle around. And sometimes it works okay. Sometimes it's very slow. Okay. We don't understand it. Technology hasn't changed much in 20 years. So we had a workshop recently at AIM in Palo Alto, American Institute for Math, where we looked at this problem from a whole lot of different angles, tried to come up with new algorithms, new loss functions, try to explain the convergence of ALS better, and that's all kind of ongoing work. Okay, cancer treatment planning, you'll hear more about that later, so I'll skip over that. Kernel estimation and clustering, I think there's people here that are interested in that, so this might be controversial, so I'll just spend the last couple of minutes on this. Okay, so this was an idea of Grace Warber about 6 or 7 years ago, and she said, okay, often I've got data sets where I'm given pairwise distances between certain pairs of objects. And I want to construct from that, I want to basically place these objects in a Euclidean space so that the placement xi, xj, and so on in that Euclidean space reflects these measured distances pretty well. Okay? So you're trying to embed it in. I know Henry's worked on this, so this kind of thing. Okay. So, you might also be interested in restricting the dimension of the space that you're placing it in. You might say, okay, can I find a placement in just three-dimensional space that does a pretty good job? Once you're placed in this space, you can sort of perform cluster analysis and you can do other things like add new data to the space. So the way that we set this up, and it's probably quite common, is that we formulated this as finding a kernel or a distance matrix K whose ij elements captured the inner products between the unknown xi and xj, okay? Because if you know all those inner products, then you can get the distance by taking simple combinations of elements of k. So this ended up being a semi-definite program where we try to fit the observed data, and we, of course, the K, if it's going to have this structure, has to be positive semi-definite. And then we sort of backed out from K. We backed out from K what the X's were by doing just an eigen decomposition. Okay. So that was the idea. All right. And you can solve semi-definite programs easily. There are really good codes out there. The only problem in this case was the dimension of the problem. It was, once you get beyond a couple of hundred variables, a semi-definite program starts to become intractable. We also tried to, here is sparse optimization again. We tried to suppress the rank of K as a way of embedding things in a lower dimensional Euclidean space. And we did that by adding on this regularization term. It's a lot like that L1 term that I had earlier. I'll just finish up with the example here that we had in the paper. So this was from a bioinformatics colleague, Sundus Kellis, and she had a bunch of proteins. The idea is to try to predict the functionality of proteins by looking at their the sequence, the DNA sequencing information. So she had a bunch of proteins that separated into four classes here. Okay, and she was trying to define the pairwise distances to be the differences between the sequence. And then she was trying to place them in a three-dimensional space using this technique that I just described to see if they clustered neatly according to their function. And it turns out that they do, that these clusters were formed using sequence information and they're colored according to functional information. And you can see that they do divide pretty neatly. Okay, and there were some more experiments we did with that. So I'm not going to get time to talk about this last thing, but I'm happy to chat with you privately about it. So thanks, Tom, for that.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.